Today we are in the middle of the most important bit of the story. And if you're here today and you wouldn't call yourself a Christian, then well done. You've managed to come on a really good week, because we're getting right at the heart of what being a Christian is about. And it's intense and it's challenging, but it's also exactly what we need to know, I think. So here's where we got to last time. After 3 years of public ministry and miracles and teaching, Jesus is arrested. He's on trial with Pontius Pilate, who is the Roman governor of Judea. The Jewish crowd had petitioned for Jesus to be executed, but Pilate was responsible, him and his people were responsible. In other words, both Jews and Gentiles who were present were responsible, i.e. everybody. And then we get to the last line of last week's passage, which was, they led him away to crucify him. They led him away to crucify him. So we now get to the horrendous story of Jesus' execution. To set the scene, the author Fleming Rutledge, who has a great name, wrote a very interesting book about the crucifixion. And she says this: without the cross at the center of Christian proclamation, the Jesus story can be treated as just another story about a charismatic spiritual figure. It is the crucifixion that marks Christianity as something definitively different in the history of religion. It is in the crucifixion that the nature of God is truly revealed. Since the resurrection is God's mighty yes to the historically crucified Son, we can assert that the crucifixion is the most important historical event that has ever happened. In other words, the death of Jesus, crucified on a Roman cross, is the most significant thing ever. And what we're going to read probably doesn't make it sound that way, because it's very matter of fact, but it is. It's not merely a philosophy or an idea, it's a historical event. But as we're going to see as well as that, it's not just an event, it's also a way. It's now a pattern for those who say that they would follow Jesus. So we're going to look at it in two parts, an event and a way. Here's what it says in Matthew 27. Then the governor's soldiers took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole company of soldiers around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand. Then they knelt in front of him and mocked him. "Hail, King of the Jews," they said. They spit on him and took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. After they had mocked him, they took off the robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. As they were going out, they met a man from Cyrene named Simon, and they forced him to carry the cross. They came to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. They offered Jesus wine to drink mixed with gall, but after tasting it, he refused to drink it. When they had crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots. And sitting down, they kept watch over him there. Above his head, they placed the written charge against him: "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Two rebels were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you're the Son of God." In the same way, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" In the same way, the rebels who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. So first thing, this is an event. It begins at the Praetorium. Jesus is taken into the Praetorium. This is basically the Roman governor's headquarters, which was a big building. There'd be a sort of courtyard in the middle, if you can picture this, that the public would not be able to see. The whole company is there. So this is not just a dozen blokes. There are probably about 600 soldiers present that attack and mock Jesus. They put a scarlet robe and a crown of thorns on him. This is designed to mock the idea that he's some sort of king. The crown of thorns would not be a piddly little thing. We're talking spikes that are several inches long and thick. and they push this down onto his head. He's already been flogged, which was so severe that a lot of people would die just from that, and they continue to hit and spit on him. Then Simon carries the cross. Now, normally when somebody was crucified, they had to carry their own cross. Big, heavy bit of wood from the praetorium in the city to the place outside where the crucifixion would happen. And that was partly so the soldiers wouldn't have to make any effort, but it's also so that the person who was going to die would be walking slowly through the streets. Everybody could see them and they'd think, oh man, whoa, they're heading for a horrible death. I wonder what they did. I'm going to make sure I don't upset the Romans because I don't want that to happen to me. Jesus has already experienced some torture before this. As I say, he's already been flogged. He's exhausted. There would be blood everywhere. That's probably why a random person is drawn from the crowd, this guy Simon, to carry the cross. They end up at Golgotha, called the place of the skull. This was a specific place outside the city walls of Jerusalem, but still quite close, where people were crucified. So on a well-established road, very visible. Again, the Romans want anyone being crucified to serve as a visible example to the rest of the population. This is what happens if you defy us, if you mess with us. And so being put outside the city, it's symbolically excluding. It's saying, this person is not part of the community. Just one way in which Jesus is mistreated. He's put outside, so to speak. He's given wine and gall to drink. What's that about? Well, this was customary for anyone who was about to be crucified. This was a concoction that would sort of numb the senses a little bit and maybe take a tiny, tiny bit of the edge off the horror of being crucified. And Jesus refuses this offer. He says he doesn't want to do it this way. He wants to be fully aware of what's happening. And then he was nailed to a cross. The Bible doesn't give us gory descriptions of the physical agony of what happened. It just says, then they crucified him. And that's because at the time, everybody would have known what a crucifixion was like. They didn't need the detail. But it's probably also to emphasize by the author that the greater aspect of Jesus' suffering, as bad as the physical is actually is the spiritual. That's the really awful thing that's happening to him. But let's consider the physical. Although the Romans did not invent crucifixion, they perfected it as a way of torture. It was designed to produce a slow death, but that was really painful at the same time. The victim's back was first torn open by scourging. Then they were thrown to the ground. They would have their hands nailed to the crossbeam. The wounds were deep. They were opened up. While they were attached to the cross, and then the cross was lifted up, every breath would cause pain, the painful wounds on the back to scrape against the wood, aggravating them further. Driving nails through the wrists, because it wasn't necessarily in the palms, it was often lower down almost by the wrist. This would sever the large median nerve. This would cause fiery pain in both hands and often resulted in a claw-like grip in the victim's hands. Death from crucifixion came from many sources. Acute shock from blood loss, being too exhausted to breathe, dehydration, stress-induced heart attack, congestive heart failure, any of these things. And because it was so awful, a Roman citizen could not be crucified. It wasn't allowed by law unless Caesar directly said. It was reserved for the worst criminals, the lowest classes. The Roman statesman Cicero said of crucifixion, "It is a crime to bind a Roman citizen. To scourge him is an act of wickedness. To execute him is almost murder. What shall I say of crucifying him? An act so abominable, it's impossible to find any word adequately to express." The Roman historian Tacitus called crucifixion a torture fit only for slaves. Fit for them because they were seen as subhuman, less than human. And that is what happened to Jesus, the Son of God, when he was crucified. By people like us. I don't know if you've ever thought of this, but crucifixion is one of the few methods of killing a person that you absolutely cannot do to yourself. You know, you can shoot yourself, stab yourself, drug yourself, drown yourself, hang yourself. It's physically impossible to crucify yourself. You can't do it. It's impossible. And I think there's something significant in that while all of this was God's plan, humanity definitely carried it out. There can't be any ambiguity here. Jesus didn't do this himself at the last minute. People did this. Humanity treated him like he was subhuman. Then we see that his clothes were gambled away. Now, given the horror of being nailed to a cross, you think, well, so what? Why bother about the clothes? Well, for one thing, this was predicted in the Old Testament, and Matthew, the author, wants to show us Jesus fulfills the Old Testament in every conceivable way. But I think it's also this. A key story right at the beginning of the Old Testament in Genesis is when the first human characters, Adam and Eve, get things wrong. And they become aware and they become responsible for the first time. They do the wrong thing. They sin, to use the Bible word for it. And then it says, then the eyes of both of them were opened and they realized they were naked. So they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings for themselves. In other words, when things had gone wrong, when sin had entered the world, one of the first things that changed was that suddenly nakedness became a vulnerability. Instantly, Adam and Eve make coverings. They hid themselves. A part of them is now private. On the cross, Jesus was fully displayed. Every covering taken away. Where we often hide our true selves, our vulnerability, our sin, our insecurity is unseen. Jesus is put on full display as he deals with these things for us. So that is the brutal, awful event of the crucifixion. Historically, that's what happened, that's what occurred. But it's also a way. It's a pattern, a sense of how God's people are called to live. Not that we all will be crucified, of course, but that we follow in the footsteps of somebody who was. And we experience little bits of what he experienced. And there's lots we could say about that, but there's one thing in particular in this passage that's very prominent and says something really important about what it means to follow in the way of Jesus. Jesus is mocked by basically everybody who happens to be around. He's mocked. Now, mockery is something that happens when people believe a person is so pitiful, so contemptible, so wrong, they can be laughed at, they can be parodied, they can't be taken seriously. And the groups that mock Jesus are each sort of symbolic of what many people do with him, depending on where they're coming from, what angle they're coming from. And these mockers represent all of us, everyone on some level mocking Jesus in their own way. First, he's mocked by the Romans, the people who are in power. Pontius Pilate, he's the governor, he has this sign put over Jesus' head. This is Jesus, King of the Jews. Which, as it happens, is true. But it's written mockingly. Pilate was saying, we Romans have got the real power. You Jewish people, well, you can do what you like. You can crown whoever you want. You all liked Jesus last week. You don't like him this week. But what doesn't change is I'm the boss around here. We're the powerful people. Today, I find it's quite common, not always, but in general, that the more powerful and wealthy you get, the less interest you have in Jesus. It happens quite often. And this, people of power and wealth, they build up their own security. You know, I've got my money, I've got my nice things, I've made life work for me, I'm the real king, I don't need Jesus. Those who have a charmed life might look at him and wonder, why do I need anything else? And this is tragic because, of course, wealth and power are always temporary. Incidentally, Pilate didn't last much longer in his powerful role because Caesar was annoyed with him and he eventually gets exiled to the desert. Didn't last forever, did it, this power? Jesus is also mocked by random strangers, people who don't know him at all. Those who passed by hurled insults at him. These are people who, they're not really involved. Maybe they've heard bits and pieces about this strange preacher. Now they see him crucified and they think, well, we can write him off then. If you're really the Son of God, come down from the cross. Which, of course, is very presumptive. It totally misses the point that, you know, why was Jesus on the cross? They don't know. They question his identity, but they are wildly uninformed. And you see exactly the same thing again today. And probably we've all done it. Jesus, if you're really the Son of God, do the thing I would do if I was you. Impress me. In other words, if you were really the Son of God, you'd be more like me, wouldn't you? It's a little bit arrogant. How often people who don't know the first thing about Jesus sadly write him off. Then you've got the religious leaders, people who are self-righteous. And the religious guys around the cross, they do know Jesus. They've interacted with him quite a lot. And they say, well, he saved others. He saved others, they know that. But he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross. Then we'll believe him. He trusts God. Let God rescue him. For he said, oh, I'm the Son of God. These men, they've seen Jesus do miracles. They have. They don't deny that they have. But it's never enough. We'll believe in him if he jumps through one more hoop. Today's religious people are not just those who say that they belong to some sort of formal religion. Religious people are the ones who are too clever for Jesus, too proud of their own moral uprightness, too unimpressed. And it can even be people who attend church every week, but they feel they're a bit too clever. This has become a bit unsophisticated. I want to focus on something else. People say, I'm good. I need to see more from Jesus if he's really worth bothering with. Again, they don't get it. It's easy to know this with hindsight, but it's precisely because Jesus doesn't come down from the cross that we now believe in him. That he did this on purpose for the very people that were mocking him. And then finally, we've got the rebels, the independent people. The rebels were these guys who were crucified next to Jesus, and they mock him as well. These people would have been political activists, opposed to Roman occupation, probably very strongly so, which is why they're being crucified. If there's anybody in dire need of rescue, it's them. And even in the middle of their own suffering, they mock Jesus, when in reality, he's exactly what they need. And today, people look for salvation, they look for meaning in politics and in rebelling against the powers that be and being all about defiance and independence. And to them, Jesus seems maybe irrelevant or useless because they haven't understood who he is and how what he is doing is so much bigger than the issues and the trendy causes of the day. And so whether it's Romans or randoms or religious leaders or rebels, notice that all this mockery straddles across conservative or liberal, religious or irreligious. It's any type of person. It's all about a heart posture towards him. And so we can conclude from this, to follow in the way of Jesus is to worship and build your life around someone who was mocked across the board. To follow in the way of Jesus is to worship and build your life around someone who was mocked across the board. What's that got to do with how we live our lives? I've got three thoughts, which I hope are practically helpful. Firstly, following Jesus means we can now handle mockery differently. If we follow somebody that was mocked, it's very likely that we will face mockery too in some way. If you've been a Christian for any length of time, you've probably experienced somebody somewhere mocking you. Now, this is different from someone just making fun of you or having a laugh at your expense. That happens to everybody. This means being mocked for being a Christian. And if that's happened to you, you'll know it's not very nice. You probably feel misunderstood and like it's not fair. And you might think, am I doing everything wrong if people react to me in this mocking way? Actually, Jesus shows us that sometimes being mocked comes with the very territory of doing it right. Unfortunately, there are some who will teach that the Christian life is an endless sequence of triumphs, and it all goes well for anybody who has enough faith. And if you're not, having endless good times as a Christian, then you must have messed it up. That's not the Christianity we find in the Bible. That's not the way that we're shown. When people are sort of triumphalist and, we'll all prosper and it'll all be great, everything is great now, that sort of idea of Christianity, I wonder what they do with this passage. Probably ignore it and move on. I've also found that when Christians, well-intentioned Christians, want to tell other people about Jesus because they've got loads of enthusiasm and Jesus changed their life and Jesus is amazing and that's all true. The temptation becomes to paint the Christian life as though it's all great, that in every moment it's wonderful, because we think, well, that will appeal to people. If we tell them how great it is all the time, that will appeal. You wouldn't want to tell people that following Jesus makes life in some way harder, would you? Well, it does. No, the pattern for the Jesus-like life, and we should be really open about this, is that it will include being misunderstood, misheard, misrepresented, and even mocked. But it also means that we have a God who understands exactly what that is like, experienced it personally. And so, yes, we can expect it to happen, but we can also put it in a different perspective because it's temporary. It won't last forever. Didn't for Jesus, won't for people who follow him. Secondly, following Jesus means we can stop being mockers ourselves. Today we saw the mockery of Romans, random strangers, religious people, rebels. But I think the modern way of doing mockery is probably best expressed with the word cynicism. And I have to say, I think this is a huge unspoken problem for the church in our part of the world. We are a cynical people. We think we're far too clever. We have a cultural air of superiority. And we might think, well, you know, I'm a Christian. Or, you know, I'm in church quite often every week. I'm not a mocker. That's not me. I wouldn't mock the ways of God. That's the other side. That's other people. But we do. And I think that the reason that we're cynical is to do with our disappointment. Show me a person who is very cynical, and I will bet that's a person who has been hugely disappointed. Life has hurt them. And very humanly, very understandably, pain after pain eventually does become cynicism. Because cynicism is a guard. It's a defense. If you expect things to be terrible, you've protected yourself when they are. Well, I knew it would be bad. And the result of all that is that when you keep doing that, you find yourself privately thinking, you may never say it out loud, you might find yourself thinking, well, God couldn't work through what's going on with me right now. There's no good reason I'm suffering this. So someone at church wasn't very nice to me. Typical. I'm not going to let that happen again. Sure, God, yeah, you're loving. Yeah, I'm, you know, whatever. Sure, I believe that. May never say it out loud, but it's there inside. The grind of life makes us cold and hard. And while there's no instant cure for cynicism, the key thing is to look at what happened on the cross. If Jesus suffered worse than you ever will, was humiliated more than you ever will be, was mocked like nobody else ever has been, and yet he's on your side, and he's the one true God, and he's going to return and make everything how we all intuitively know that it should be, how could that not eventually turn our cynicism into joy and trust? How could we remain among the mockers? And so while the world gives us lots of good reasons to be cynical, it does, Jesus turns it around. He flips the coin. Without him, go ahead, be cynical. Why not? But with him, there is every reason to be thankful and humble and glad. Third thing, following Jesus means that we understand that his mockery is our glory. You know, I think the fear of being mocked is one of the big things that holds back most Christians. You know, where we live, we're unlikely to be arrested or killed or anything like that for following Jesus. But when we do things that are not what the rest of our culture tells us to do for the sake of doing what he says, we're probably going to get mocked. When people will say to us, well, that's ridiculous. You know, you can't do that. You can't believe that. You can't think that. You're stupid. Now, I'm the sort of person, if anyone says that sort of thing to me, I want to get into an argument with them. That's my temptation. I want to demonstrate, no, I'm not stupid. If you disagree with me, then surely you're stupid, is how I secretly, not so secretly, think. Jesus does not respond to mockery the way that I am tempted to do and occasionally do. He stays silent, not indifferent, not pretending he doesn't care, but he stays silent. He just takes it. No arguments, no protests. That's because as much as everything that happens to Jesus is awful, he is laser focused on the big picture. He takes on this ordeal because bearing pain and shame and humiliation is, remarkably, somehow, the way that he defeats those things permanently. You know, the people gathered around the cross mocking him had no idea how great he was. Mockery, like they show us, is simply a blindness to the incredible ways of God. He doesn't do it how I do it, so let's write him off. A man nailed to a cross, well, how could that be anything? But in the face of this, the mockery, the pain, etc., etc., on the cross, Jesus did not flinch. It's the greatest act of self-control ever. Crucifixion was the worst of punishments, the worst of things, because it wasn't just the physical side, it was the public lifting up and humiliation. Not just killing your body, but killing your name, your reputation, all of you. And Jesus took it. Why? Jesus thought it was worth the awfulness of the cross to get us. It's the simplest way I can put it. Jesus thought it was worth the awfulness of the cross, all of the levels of it, to get us. And so following him is decidedly inconvenient for our time, our money, our relationships, our social standing. It means being willing to be mocked, potentially, by people of all stripes, the powerful, the unknowing, the self-righteous, the rebellious. But we follow him as Christians because it's worth it. Because what he did for us is the best news that we could have. Because our glory, the thing that we take joy in the most, is our signed and sealed forever relationship with God that has been accomplished through what he did on the cross 2,000 years ago.